which was sunk by the British off the southern coast of Portugal in 1804. Stem proved to be a representative hunter of positive black swans, and someone who can illustrate that such a search is a highly controlled form of randomness. I met him and shared ideas with him. His investors, like mine at the time, as I was still involved in that business, were for the most part not programmed to understand that for a treasure hunter, a bad quarter, meaning expenses of searching but no finds, was not indicative of distress, as it would be with a steady cash flow business like that of a dentist or prostitute. By some mental domain dependence, people can spend money on, say, office furniture and not call it a loss, rather an investment, but would treat cost of search as loss. Stem's method is as follows. He does an extensive analysis of the general area where the ship could be. That data is synthesized into a map drawn with squares of probability. A search area is then designed, taking into account that they must have certainty that the shipwreck is not in a specific area before moving on to a lower probability area. It looks random, but it is not. It is the equivalent of looking for a treasure in your house. Every search has incrementally a higher probability of yielding a result, but only if you can be certain that the area you have searched does not hold the treasure. Some listeners might not be too excited about the morality of shipwreck hunting, and could consider that these treasures are national, not private property. So let us change domain. The method used by Stem applies to oil and gas exploration, particularly at the bottom of the unexplored oceans, with a difference. In a shipwreck, the upside is limited to the value of the treasure, whereas oil fields and other natural resources are nearly unlimited, or have a very high limit. Finally, recall my discussion of random drilling in Chapter 6 and how it seemed superior to more directed techniques. This optionality-driven method of search is not foolishly random. Thanks to optionality, it becomes tamed and harvested randomness. Creative and uncreative destructions. Someone who got a minor version of the point that generalized trial and error has, well, errors, but without much grasp of asymmetry, or what, since Chapter 12, we have been calling optionality, is the economist Joseph Schumpeter. He realized that some things need to break for the system to improve. What is labeled creative destruction, a notion developed among so many other ones by the philosopher Karl Marx, and a concept discovered, we will show in Chapter 17, by Nietzsche. But a reading of Schumpeter shows that he did not think in terms of uncertainty and opacity. He was completely smoked by interventionism, under the illusion that governments could innovate by fiat, something that we will contradict in a few pages. Nor did he grasp the notion of layering of evolutionary tensions. More crucially, both he and his detractors, Harvard economists who thought that he did not know mathematics, missed the notion of anti-fragility as asymmetry, optionality effects, hence the philosopher's stone, on which later, as the agent of growth. That is, they missed half of life. The Soviet Harvard Department of Ornithology. Now, since a very large share of technological know-how comes from the anti-fragility, the optionality of trial and error, some people and some institutions want to hide the fact from us and themselves, or downplay its role. Consider two types of knowledge. The first type is not exactly knowledge. Its ambiguous character prevents us from associating it with the strict definitions of knowledge. It is a way of doing things that we cannot really express in clear and direct language. It is sometimes called apophatic, but that we do nevertheless, and do well. The second type is more like what we call knowledge. It is what you acquire in school, can get grades for, can codify, what is explainable, academizable, rationalizable, formalizable, theoretizable, codifiable, Sovietizable, bureaucratizable, Harvardifiable, provable, etc. The error of naive rationalism leads to overestimating the role and necessity of the second type, academic knowledge, in human affairs, and degrading the uncodifiable, more complex, intuitive, or experience-based type. There is no proof against the statement that the role such explainable knowledge plays in life is so minor that it is not even funny. We are very likely to believe that skills and ideas that we actually acquired by anti-fragile doing, or that came naturally to us from our innate biological instinct, came from books, ideas, and reasoning. We get blinded by it. There may even be something in our brains that makes us suckers for the point. Let us see how. I recently looked for definitions of technology. Most texts define it as the application of scientific knowledge to practical projects, leading us to believe in a flow of knowledge going chiefly, even exclusively, from lofty science, organized around a priestly group of persons with titles before their names, to lowly practice, exercised by uninitiated people without the intellectual attainments to gain membership into the priestly group. So, in the corpus, knowledge is presented as derived in the following manner. Basic research yields scientific knowledge, which in turn generates technologies, which in turn lead to practical applications, which in turn lead to economic growth and other seemingly interesting matters. The payoff from the investment in basic research will be partly directed to more investments in basic research, and the citizens will prosper and enjoy the benefits of such knowledge-derived wealth with Volvo cars, ski vacations, Mediterranean diets, and long summer hikes in beautifully maintained public parks. This is called the Baconian linear model, after the philosopher of science Francis Bacon. I am adapting its representation by the scientist Terence Keeley, who, crucially, as a biochemist, is a practicing scientist, not a historian of science. As follows. Academia leads to applied science and technology leads to practice. While this model may be valid in some very narrow but highly advertised instances, such as building the atomic bomb, the exact reverse seems to be true in most of the domains I've examined. Or, at least, this model is not guaranteed to be true, and, what is shocking, we have no rigorous evidence that it is true. It may be that academia helps science and technology, which in turn help practice, but in unintended, non-teleological ways, as we will see later. In other words, it is directed research that may well be an illusion. Let us return to the metaphor of the birds. Think of the following event. A collection of hieretic persons, from Harvard or some such place, lecture birds on how to fly. Imagine bald males in their 60s, dressed in black robes, officiating in a form of English that is full of jargon, with equations here and there for good measure. The bird flies. Wonderful confirmation. They rush to the Department of Ornithology to write books, articles, and reports stating that the bird has obeyed them, an impeccable causal inference. The Harvard Department of Ornithology is now indispensable for bird flying. It will get government research funds for its contribution. Mathematics leads to ornithological navigation and wing flapping technologies leads to ungrateful birds fly. It also happens that birds write no such papers and books, conceivably because they are just birds, so we never get their side of the story. Meanwhile, the priests keep broadcasting theirs to the new generation of humans who are completely unaware of the conditions of the pre-Harvard lecturing days. Nobody discusses the possibility of the birds not needing lectures, and nobody has any incentive to look at the number of birds that fly without such help from the great scientific establishment. The problem is that what I wrote above looks ridiculous, but a change of domain makes it look reasonable. Clearly, we never think that it is thanks to ornithologists that birds learn to fly, and if some people do hold such a belief, it would be hard for them to convince the birds. But why is it that when we anthropomorphize and replace birds with men, the idea that people learn to do things thanks to lectures becomes plausible? When it comes to human agency, matters suddenly become confusing to us. So the illusion grows and grows, with government funding, tax dollars, swelling and self-feeding bureaucracies in Washington, all devoted to helping birds fly better. Problems occur when people start cutting such funding, with a spate of accusations of killing birds by not helping them fly. As per the Yiddish saying, if the student is smart, the teacher takes the credit. These illusions of contribution result largely from confirmation fallacies. In addition to the sad fact that history belongs to those who can write about it, whether winners or losers, a second bias appears, as those who write the accounts can deliver confirmatory facts, what has worked, but not a complete picture of what has worked and what has failed. For instance, directed research would tell you what has worked from funding, like AIDS drugs or some modern designer drugs, not what has failed. So you may have the impression that it fares better than random. And of course, iatrogenics is never part of the discourse. They never tell you if education hurts you in some places. So we are blind to the possibility of the alternative process, or the role of such a process, a loop. Random tinkering, anti-fragile, leads to heuristics, technology, leads to practice and apprenticeship, leads to random tinkering, anti-fragile, leads to heuristics, technology, leads to practice and apprenticeship. In parallel to the above loop, practice leads to academic theories, leads to academic theories, leads to academic theories, leads to academic theories, with, of course, some exceptions, some accidental leaks, though these are indeed rare and overhyped and grossly generalized. Now, crucially, one can detect the scam in the so-called Baconian model by looking at events in the days that preceded the Harvard lectures on flying and examining the birds. This is what I accidentally found, indeed, accidentally, in my own career as practitioner-turned-researcher in volatility, thanks to some lucky turn of events. But before that, let me explain epiphenomena and the arrow of education. Epiphenomena. The Soviet Harvard illusion, lecturing birds on flying and believing that the lecture is the cause of these wonderful skills, belongs to a class of causal illusions called epiphenomena. What are these illusions? When you spend time on the bridge of a ship or in the coxswain station with a large compass in front, you can easily develop the impression that the compass is directing the ship rather than merely reflecting its direction. The lecturing birds how to fly effect is an example of epiphenomenal belief. We see a high degree of academic research in countries that are wealthy and developed, leading us to think uncritically that research is the generator of wealth. In an epiphenomenon, you don't usually observe A without observing B with it, so you are likely to think that A causes B, or that B causes A, depending on the cultural framework or what seems plausible to the local journalist. One rarely has the illusion that, given that so many boys have short hair determines gender, or that wearing a tie causes one to become a businessman. But it is easy to fall into other epiphenomena, particularly when one is immersed in a news-driven culture. And one can easily see the trap of having these epiphenomena fuel action, then justify it retrospectively. A dictator, just like a government, will feel indispensable because the alternative is not easily visible, or is hidden by special interest groups. The Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, for instance, can wreak havoc on the economy, yet feel convinced of its effectiveness. People are scared of the alternative. Greed as a cause. Whenever an economic crisis occurs, greed is pointed to as the cause, which leaves us with the impression that if we could go to the root of greed and extract it from life, crises would be eliminated. Further, we tend to believe that greed is new, since these wild economic crises are new. This is an epiphenomenon. Greed is much older than systemic fragility. It existed as far back as the eye can go into history. From Virgil's mention of greed of gold and the expression radix malorum est cupiditas, from the Latin version of the New Testament, both expressed more than 20 centuries ago, we know that the same problems of greed have been propounded through the centuries, with no cure, of course, in spite of the variety of political systems we have developed since then. Trollope's novel, The Way We Live Now, published close to a century and a half ago, shows the exact same complaint of a resurgence of greed and con operators that I heard in 1988 with cries over the greed decade, or in 2008 with denunciations of the greed of capitalism. With astonishing regularity, greed is seen as something A, new, and B, curable. A Procrustean bed approach. We cannot change humans as easily as we can build greed-proof systems, and nobody thinks of simple solutions. Is democracy epiphenomenal? Supposedly, democracy works because of this hallowed rational decision-making on the part of voters. but consider that democracy may be something completely accidental to something else, the side effect of people liking to cast ballots for completely obscure reasons, just as people enjoy expressing themselves just to express themselves. I once put this question at a political science conference and got absolutely nothing beyond blank, nerdy faces, not even a smile. Likewise, lack of vigilance is often proposed as the cause of an error, as we will see with the Société Générale story in Book 5. The cause was size and fragility. But lack of vigilance is not the cause of the death of a mafia don. The cause of death is making enemies, and the cure is making friends. Debunking epiphenomena. We can dig out epiphenomena in the cultural discourse and consciousness by looking at the sequence of events and checking whether one always precedes the other. This is a method refined by the late Clive Granger, himself a refined gentleman, a well-deserved Nobel in economics, that Bank of Sweden, Sveriges Riksbank Prize in honor of Alfred Nobel that has been given to a large number of fragilistas. It is the only rigorously scientific technique that philosophers of science can use to establish causation, as they can now extract, if not measure, the so-called Granger cause by looking at sequences. In epiphenomenal situations, you end up seeing A and B together. But if you refine your analysis by considering the sequence, thus introducing a time dimension, which takes place first, A or B, and analyze evidence, then you will see if truly A causes B. Further, Granger had the great idea of studying differences, that is, changes in A and B, not just levels of A and B. While I do not believe that Granger's method can lead me to believe that A causes B with certainty, it can most certainly help me debunk fake causation and allow me to make the claim that the statement that B causes A is wrong or has insufficient evidence from the sequence. The important difference between theory and practice lies precisely in the detection of the sequence of events and retaining the sequence in memory. If life is lived forward but remembered backward, as Schopenhauer observed, then books exacerbate this effect. Our own memories, learning, and instinct have sequences in them. Someone standing today looking at events without having lived them would be inclined to develop illusions of causality, mostly from being mixed up by the sequence of events. In real life, in spite of all the biases, we do not have the same number of asynchronies that appear to the student of history. Nasty history, full of lies, full of biases. For one example of a trick for debunking causality, I am not even dead yet, but I'm already seeing distortions about my work. Authors theorize about some ancestry of my ideas, as if people read books then developed ideas, not wondering whether perhaps it is the other way around. People look for books that support their mental program. So one journalist, Anatole Kaletsky, saw the influence of Benoit Mandelbrot on my book Fooled by Randomness, published in 2001, when I did not know who Mandelbrot was. It is simple. The journalist saw similarities of thought in one type of domain, and seniority of age, and immediately drew the false inference. He did not consider that like-minded people are inclined to hang together, and that such intellectual similarity caused the relationship, rather than the reverse. This makes me suspicious of the master-pupil relationships we read about in cultural history, about all the people that have been called my pupils, have been my pupils because we were like-minded. Cherry-picking, or the fallacy of confirmation. Consider the tourist brochures used by countries to advertise their wares. You can expect that the pictures presented to you will look much, much better than anything you will encounter in the place. And the bias, the difference, for which humans correct, thanks to common sense, can be measured as the country shown in the tourist brochure minus the country seen with your naked eyes. That difference can be small or large. We also make such corrections with commercial products, not overly trusting advertising. But we don't correct for the difference in science, medicine, and mathematics, for the same reasons we didn't pay attention to iatrogenics. We are suckers for the sophisticated. In institutional research, one can selectively report facts that confirm one's story, without revealing facts that disprove it or don't apply to it. So the public perception of science is biased into believing in the necessity of the highly conceptualized, crisp, and purified Harvardized methods. And statistical research tends to be marred with this one-sidedness. Another reason one should trust the disconfirmatory more than the confirmatory. Academia is well equipped to tell us what it did for us, not what it did not, hence how indispensable its methods are. This ranges across many things in life. Traders talk about their successes, so one is led to believe that they are intelligent, not looking at the hidden failures. As to academic science, a few years ago, the great Anglo-Lebanese mathematician Michael Atiyah of string theory fame came to New York to raise funds for a research center in mathematics based in Lebanon. In his speech, he enumerated applications in which mathematics turned out to be useful for society in modern life, such as traffic signaling. Fine. But what about areas where mathematics led us to disaster, as in, say, economics or finance, where it blew up the system? And how about areas out of the reach of mathematics? I thought right there of a different project, a catalog of where mathematics fails to produce results, hence causes harm. Cherry-picking has optionality. The one telling the story, and publishing it, has the advantage of being able to show the confirmatory examples and completely ignore the rest. And the more volatility and dispersion, the rosier the best story will be, and the darker the worst story. Someone with optionality, the right to pick and choose his story, is only reporting on what suits his purpose. You take the upside of your story and hide the downside, so only the sensational seems to count. The real world relies on the intelligence of anti-fragility, but no university would swallow that, just as interventionists don't accept that things can improve without their intervention. Let us return to the idea that universities generate wealth and the growth of useful knowledge in society. There is a causal illusion here. Time to bust it. Chapter 14. The Green Lumber Problem. Tension between episteme and trial and error, and the role through history. Does knowledge generate wealth, and if so, which knowledge? When two things are not the same thing. Green lumber, another blue. Where we look for the arrow of discovery. Putting Iraq in the middle of Pakistan. Prometheus never looked back. I am writing these lines in an appropriate place to think about the arrow of knowledge. Abu Dhabi, a city that sprang out of the desert as if watered by oil. It makes me queasy to see the building of these huge universities, funded by the oil revenues of governments, under the notion that oil reserves can be turned into knowledge by hiring professors from prestigious universities and putting their kids through school, or, as is the case, waiting for their kids to feel the desire to go to school, as many students in Abu Dhabi are from Bulgaria, Serbia, or Macedonia getting a free education. Even better, they can, with a single check, import an entire school from overseas, such as the Sorbonne and New York University, among many more. So, in a few years, members of this society will be reaping the benefits of a great technological improvement. It would seem a reasonable investment if one accepts the notion that university knowledge generates economic wealth. But this is a belief that comes more from superstition than empiricism. Remember the story of Switzerland in Chapter 5, a place with a very low level of formal education. I wonder if my nausea comes from the feeling that these desert tribes are being separated from their money by the establishment that has been sucking dry their resources and diverting them to administrators from Western universities. Their wealth came from oil, not from some vocational know-how. So I am certain that their spending on education is completely sterile and a great transfer of resources, rather than milking anti-fragility by forcing their citizens to make money naturally through circumstances. Where are the stressors? There is something that escapes the Abu Dhabi model. Where are the stressors? Recall the quote by Seneca and Ovid to the effect that sophistication is born of need and success of difficulties. In fact, many such variations, sourced in medieval days, such as necessitas magistra in Erasmus, found their way into our daily vernaculars, as in, necessity is the mother of invention. The best is, as usual, from the master aphorist Publilius Cyrus, "Poverty makes experiences. Hominum experere multa paupertas iubet." But the expression and idea appear in one form or another in so many classical writers, including Euripides, Pseudo-Theocritus, Plautus, Apuleius, Zenobius, Juvenal, and of course it is now labeled post-traumatic growth. I saw ancient wisdom at work in the exact opposite of the situation in Abu Dhabi. My Levantine village of origin, Amyon, was pillaged and evacuated during the war, sending its inhabitants into exile across the planet. 25 years later, it became opulent, having bounced back with a vengeance. My own house, dynamited, is now bigger than the previous version. My father, showing me the multiplication of villas in the countryside while bemoaning these nouveau riches, calmly told me, "You too, had you stayed here, would have become a beach bum. People from Amyon only do well when shaken." That's anti-fragility. L'art pour l'art. To learn for learning's sake. Now let's look at evidence of the direction of the causal arrow. That is, whether it is true that lecture-driven knowledge leads to prosperity. Serious empirical investigation, largely thanks to one Lant Pritchett, then a World Bank economist, shows no evidence that raising the general level of education raises income at the level of a country. But we know the opposite is true, that wealth leads to the rise of education, not an optical illusion. We don't need to resort to the World Bank figures. We could derive this from an armchair. Let us figure out the direction of the arrow. Education yields wealth and economic growth, or wealth and economic growth yield education. And the evidence is so easy to check, just lying out there in front of us. It can be obtained by looking at countries that are both wealthy and have some level of education, and considering which condition preceded the other. Take the following potent and less-is-more style argument by the rogue economist Ha-Jun Chang. In 1960, Taiwan had a much lower literacy rate than the Philippines, and half the income per person. Today, Taiwan has 10 times the income. At the same time, Korea had a much lower literacy rate than Argentina, which had one of the highest in the world, and about 1/5 the income per person. Today, it has 3 times as much. Further, over the same period, sub-Saharan Africa saw markedly increasing literacy rates, accompanied with a decrease in their standard of living. We can multiply the examples. Pritchett's study is quite thorough. But I wonder why people don't realize the simple truism, that is, the fooled-by-randomness effect. Mistaking the merely associative for the causal, that is, if rich countries are educated, immediately inferring that education makes a country rich, without even checking. Epiphenomenon here again. The error in reasoning is a bit from wishful thinking, because education is considered good. I wonder why people don't make the epiphenomenal association between the wealth of a country and something bad, say, decadence, and infer that decadence, or some other disease of wealth like a high suicide rate, also generates wealth. I am not saying that for an individual, education is useless. It builds helpful credentials for one's own career. But such effect washes out at the country level. Education stabilizes the income of families across generations. A merchant makes money, then his children go to the Sorbonne. They become doctors and magistrates. The family retains wealth because the diplomas allow members to remain in the middle class long after the ancestral wealth is depleted. But these effects don't count for countries. Further, Alison Wolfe debunks the flaw in logic in going from the point that it is hard to imagine Microsoft or British Aerospace without advanced knowledge to the idea that more education means more wealth. The simple one-way relationship which so entrances our politicians and commentators, education spending in, economic growth out, simply doesn't exist. Moreover, the larger and more complex the education sector, the less obvious any links to productivity become. And, similar to Pritchett, she looks at countries such as, say, Egypt, and shows how the giant leap in education it underwent did not translate into the highly cherished golden GDP growth that makes countries important or unimportant on the ranking tables. This argument is not against adopting governmental educational policies for noble aims such as reducing inequality in the population, allowing the poor to access good literature and read Dickens, Victor Hugo, or Julian Gracz, or increasing the freedom of women in poor countries, which happens to decrease the birth rate. But then one should not use the excuses of growth or wealth in such matters. I once ran into Alison Wolfe at a party. Parties are great for optionality. As I got her to explain to other people her evidence about the lack of effectiveness of funding formal education, one person got frustrated with our skepticism. Wolfe's answer to him was, "Real education is this," pointing at the room full of people chatting. Accordingly, I am not saying that knowledge is not important. The skepticism in this discussion applies to the brand of commoditized, pre-packaged, and pink-coated knowledge, stuff one can buy in the open market and use for self-promotion. Further, let me remind the reader that scholarship and organized education are not the same. Another party story. Once at a formal fancy dinner, a fellow in a quick speech deplored the education level in the United States, falling for the kind of low math grades alarmism. Although I agreed with all his other views, I felt compelled to intervene. I interrupted him to state the point that America's values were convex risk-taking, and that I am glad that we are not like these helicopter mom cultures, the kind of thing I am writing here. Everyone was shocked, either confused or in heavy but passive disagreement, except for one person who came to lend her support to me. It turned out that she was the head of the New York City school system. Also, note that I am not saying that universities do not generate knowledge at all and do not help growth, outside, of course, of most standard economics and other superstitions that set us back. All I am saying is that their role is overly hyped up, and that their members seem to exploit some of the gullibility we have in establishing wrong causal links, mostly on superficial impressions. Polished dinner partners. Education has benefits aside from stabilizing family incomes. Education makes individuals more polished dinner partners, for instance, something non-negligible. But the idea of educating people to improve the economy is rather novel. The British government documents, as early as 50 years ago, an aim for education other than the one we have today. Raising values, making good citizens, and learning, not economic growth. They were not suckers at the time. A point also made by Alison Wolfe. Likewise, in ancient times, learning was for learning's sake, to make someone a good person worth talking to, not to increase the stock of gold in the city's heavily guarded coffers. Entrepreneurs, particularly those in technical jobs, are not necessarily the best people to have dinner with. I recall a heuristic I used in my previous profession when hiring people, called "Separate those who, when they go to a museum, look at the Cézanne on the wall, from those who focus on the contents of the trash can." The more interesting their conversation, the more cultured they are, the more they will be trapped into thinking that they are effective at what they are doing in real business, something psychologists call the halo effect, the mistake of thinking that skills in, say, skiing translate unfailingly into skills in managing a pottery workshop or a bank department, or that a good chess player would be a good strategist in real life. The halo effect is largely the opposite of domain dependence. Clearly, it is unrigorous to equate skills at doing with skills at talking. My experience of good practitioners is that they can be totally incomprehensible. They do not have to put much energy in turning their insights and internal coherence into elegant style and narratives. Entrepreneurs are selected to be just doers, not thinkers, and doers do, they don't talk, and it would be unfair, wrong, and downright insulting to measure them in the talk department. The same with artisans. The quality lies in their product, not their conversation. In fact, they can easily have false beliefs that, as a side effect, inverse iatrogenics, lead them to make better products. So what? Bureaucrats, on the other hand, because of the lack of an objective metric of success and the absence of market forces, are selected on the halo effects of shallow looks and elegance. The side effect is to make them better at conversation. I am quite certain a dinner with a United Nations employee would cover more interesting subjects than one with some of Fat Tony's cousins or a computer entrepreneur obsessed with circuits. Let us look deeper at this flaw in thinking. The Green Lumber Fallacy. In one of the rare non-charlatanic books in finance, descriptively called What I Learned Losing $1 Million, the protagonist makes a big discovery. He remarks that a fellow named Joe Siegel, one of the most successful traders in a commodity called green lumber, actually thought that it was lumber painted green, rather than freshly cut lumber, called green because it had not been dried. And he made it his profession to trade the stuff. Meanwhile, the narrator was into grand intellectual theories and narratives of what caused the price of commodities to move, and went bust. It is not just that the successful expert on lumber was ignorant of central matters like the designation green. He also knew things about lumber that non-experts think are unimportant. People we call ignorant might not be ignorant. The fact is that predicting the order flow in lumber and the usual narrative had little to do with the details one would assume from the outside are important. People who do things in the field are not subjected to a set exam. They are selected in the most non-narrative manner. Nice arguments don't make much difference. Evolution does not rely on narratives. Humans do. Evolution does not need a word for the color blue. So let us call the green lumber fallacy the situation in which one mistakes a source of necessary knowledge, the greenness of lumber, for another, less visible from the outside, less tractable, less narratable. My intellectual world was shattered as if everything I had studied was not just useless, but a well-organized scam, as follows. When I first became a derivatives or volatility professional, I specialized in non-linearities, I focused on exchange rates, a field in which I was embedded for several years. I had to cohabit with foreign exchange traders, people who were not involved in technical instruments as I was. Their job simply consisted of buying and selling currencies. Money changing is a very old profession with a long tradition and craft. Recall the story of Jesus Christ and the money changers. Coming to this from a highly polished Ivy League environment, I was in for a bit of a shock. You would think that the people who specialized in foreign exchange understood economics, geopolitics, mathematics, the future price of currencies, differentials between prices in countries, or that they read assiduously the economics reports published in glossy papers by various institutes. You might also imagine cosmopolitan fellows who wear ascots at the opera on Saturday night, make wine sommeliers nervous, and take tango lessons on Wednesday afternoons, or spoke intelligible English. None of that. My first day on the job was an astounding discovery of the real world. The population in foreign exchange was at the time mostly composed of New Jersey, Brooklyn, Italian fellows. Those were street, very street people, who started in the back office of banks doing wire transfers, and when the market expanded, even exploded, with the growth of commerce and the free floating of currencies, they developed into traders and became prominent in the business, and prosperous. My first conversation with an expert was with a fellow called B. something that ends with a vowel, dressed in a handmade Brioni suit. I was told that he was the biggest Swiss franc trader in the world, a legend in his day. He had predicted the big dollar collapse in the 1980s and controlled huge positions. But a short conversation with him revealed that he could not place Switzerland on the map. Foolish as I was, I thought he was Swiss-Italian. Yet he did not know there were Italian-speaking people in Switzerland. He had never been there. When I saw that he was not the exception, I started freaking out, watching all these years of education evaporating in front of my eyes. That very same day, I stopped reading economic reports. I felt nauseous for a while during this enterprise of de-intellectualization. In fact, I may not have recovered yet. If New York was blue-collar in origin, London was sub-blue-collar and even more successful. The players were entirely Cockney, even more separated from sentence-forming society. They were East Londoners, street people, extremely street, with a distinctive accent, using their own numbering system. 5 is Lady Godiva, or Ching. 15 is a Commodore. 25 is a Pony, etc. I had to learn Cockney just to communicate, and mostly to go drinking, with my colleagues during my visits there. At the time, London traders got drunk almost every day at lunch, especially on Friday, before New York opened. Beer turns you into a lion, one fellow told me, as he hurried to finish his drink before the New York Open. The most hilarious scenes were hearing on loudspeakers transatlantic conversations between New York Bensonhurst folks and Cockney brokers, particularly when the Brooklyn fellow tried to put on a little bit of a Cockney pronunciation to be understood. These Cockneys sometimes spoke no standard English. So that is how I learned the lesson that price and reality, as seen by economists, are not the same thing. One may be a function of the other, but the function is too complex to map mathematically. The relation may have optionality in places, something that these non-sentence-savvy people knew deep inside. How Fat Tony Got Rich and Fat. Fat Tony got to become, literally, Fat Tony, rich and heavier, in the aftermath of the Kuwait War. The sequence was conventional, that is, first rich, then fat. It was in January 1991, on the day the United States attacked Baghdad to restitute Kuwait, which Iraq had invaded. Every intelligent person in socioeconomics had his theory, probabilities, scenarios, and all that, except Fat Tony. He didn't even know where Iraq was, whether it was a province in Morocco or some emirate with spicy food east of Pakistan. He didn't know the food, so the place did not exist for him. All he knew is that suckers exist. If you asked any intelligent analyst or journalist at the time, he would have predicted a rise in the price of oil in the event of war. But that causal link was precisely what Tony could not take for granted. So he bet against it. They are all prepared for a rise in oil from war, so the price must have adjusted to it. War could cause a rise in oil prices, but not scheduled war, since prices adjust to expectations. It has to be in the price, as he said. Indeed, on the news of war, oil collapsed from around $39 a barrel to almost half that value, and Tony turned his investment of $300,000 into $18 million. There are so few occasions in one's life, you can't miss them, he later told Nero during one of their lunches as he was convincing his non-New Jersey friend to bet on a collapse of the financial system. Good speculative bets come to you. You don't get them by just staying focused on the news. And note the main Fat Tony statement, Kuwait and oil are not the same thing. This will be a platform for our notion of conflation. Tony had greater upside than downside, and for him, that was it. Indeed, many people lost their shirt from the drop of oil while correctly predicting war. They just thought it was the same thing. But there had been too much hoarding, too much inventory. I remember going around that time into the office of a large fund manager who had a map of Iraq on the wall in a war room-like setting. Members of the team knew every possible thing about Kuwait, Iraq, Washington, the United Nations, except for the very simple fact that it had nothing to do with oil, not the same thing. All these analyses were nice, but not too connected to anything. Of course, the fellow got subsequently shellacked by the drop in oil price and, from what I heard, went to law school. Aside from the non-narrative view of things, another lesson. People with too much smoke and complicated tricks and methods in their brain start missing elementary, very elementary things. Persons in the real world can't afford to miss these things, otherwise they crash the plane. Unlike researchers, they were selected for survival, not complications. So I saw the less is more in action. The more studies, the less obvious, elementary, but fundamental things become. Activity, on the other hand, strips things to their simplest possible model. Conflation. Of course, so many things are not the same thing in life. Let us generalize the conflation. This lesson, not the same thing, is quite general. When you have optionality or some anti-fragility and can identify betting opportunities with big upside and small downside, what you do is only remotely connected to what Aristotle thinks you do. There is something, here perception, ideas, theories, and a function of something, here a price or reality or something real. The conflation problem is to mistake one for the other, forgetting that there is a function and that such function has different properties. Now, the more asymmetries there are between the something and the function of something, then the more difference there is between the two. They may end up having nothing to do with each other. This seems trivial, but there are big-time implications. As usual, science, not social science, but smart science, gets it. Someone who escaped the conflation problem is Jim Simons, the great mathematician who made a fortune building a huge machine to transact across markets. It replicates the buying and selling methods of these sub-blue-collar people and has more statistical significance than anyone on planet Earth. He claims to never hire economists and finance people, just physicists and mathematicians, those involved in pattern recognition, accessing the internal logic of things, without theorizing. Nor does he ever listen to economists or read their reports. The great economist Ariel Rubinstein gets the green lumber fallacy. It requires a great deal of intellect and honesty to see things that way. Rubinstein is one of the leaders in the field of game theory, which consists in thought experiments. He is also the greatest expert in cafes for thinking and writing across the planet. Rubinstein refuses to claim that his knowledge of theoretical matters can be translated, by him, into anything directly practical. To him, economics is like a fable. A fable writer is there to stimulate ideas, indirectly inspire practice, perhaps, but certainly not to direct or determine practice. Theory should stay independent from practice, and vice versa, and we should not extract academic economists from their campuses and put them in positions of decision-making. Economics is not a science and should not be there to advise policy. In his intellectual memoirs, Rubinstein recounts how he tried to get a Levantine vendor in a souk to apply ideas from game theory to his bargaining in place of ancestral mechanisms. The suggested method failed to produce a price acceptable to both parties. Then the fellow told him, "For generations we have bargained in our way, and you come and try to change it?" Rubinstein concluded, "I parted from him shamefaced." All we need is another two people like Rubinstein in that profession, and things will be better on planet Earth. Sometimes, even when an economic theory makes sense, its application cannot be imposed from a model in a top-down manner, so one needs the organic self-driven trial and error to get us to it. For instance, the concept of specialization that has obsessed economists since Ricardo and before blows up countries when imposed by policymakers, as it makes the economies error-prone, but it works well when reached progressively by evolutionary means, with the right buffers and layers of redundancies. Another case where economists may inspire us, but should never tell us what to do. The difference between a narrative and practice, the important things that cannot be easily narrated, lies mainly in optionality, the missed optionality of things. The right thing here is typically an anti-fragile payoff. And my argument is that you don't go to school to learn optionality, but the reverse, to become blind to it. Prometheus and Epimetheus. In Greek legend, there were two Titan brothers, Prometheus and Epimetheus. Prometheus means forethinker, while Epimetheus means afterthinker, equivalent to someone who falls for the retrospective distortion of fitting theories to past events in an ex-post narrative manner. Prometheus gave us fire and represents the progress of civilization, while Epimetheus represents backward thinking, staleness, and lack of intelligence. It was Epimetheus who accepted Pandora's gift, the large jar, with irreversible consequences. Optionality is Promethean, narratives are Epimethean. One has reversible and benign mistakes. The other symbolizes the gravity and irreversibility of the consequences of opening Pandora's box. You make forays into the future by opportunism and optionality. So far in Book 4, We have seen the power of optionality as an alternative way of doing things, opportunistically, with some large edge to them coming from asymmetry with large benefits and benign harm. It is a way, the only way, to domesticate uncertainty, to work rationally without understanding the future, while reliance on narratives is the exact opposite. One is domesticated by uncertainty and, ironically, set back. You cannot look at the future by naive projection of the past. This brings us to the difference between doing and thinking. The point is hard to understand from the vantage point of intellectuals. As Yogi Berra said, in theory, there is no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. So far, we have seen arguments that intellect is associated with fragility and instills methods that conflict with tinkering. So far, we saw the option as the expression of anti-fragility. We separated knowledge into two categories, the formal and the fat-tonyish, heavily grounded in the anti-fragility of trial and error and risk-taking, with less downside, barbell style, a de-intellectualized form of risk-taking, or rather, intellectual in its own way. In an opaque world, that is the only way to go. Table 4 summarizes the different aspects of the opposition between narrating and tinkering, the subject of the next three chapters. Table 4. The difference between the teleological and optionality. Narrative knowledge hates uncertainty, is fragile to change or turkey-style misunderstanding of the past. Anti-fragile, optionality-driven tinkering, trial and error, domesticates uncertainty, is anti-fragile to the unknown. Narrative knowledge looks at the past, subject to overfitting to the past. Optionality looks at the future. Narrative knowledge is like Epimetheus. Optionality is like Prometheus. Narrative knowledge involves teleological action. Optionality involves opportunistic action. Narrative knowledge is tourist style. Optionality is flaneur style. Narrative knowledge is fragile, naive rationality. Optionality is robust rationality. Narrative knowledge is psychologically comfortable. Optionality is psychologically uncomfortable, but has a sense of thrill and adventure. Narrative knowledge is concave, visible known gains, unknown errors. Optionality is convex, small known errors, large possible gains. Narrative knowledge is subjected to turkey problems, mistaking evidence of absence for absence of evidence. Optionality can benefit from suckers and turkey problems. Narrative knowledge is subjected to epiphenomena and the green lumber fallacy. Optionality escapes the green lumber fallacy. Narrative knowledge is academia's sole mechanism outside laboratory and physical science. Optionality is practice's main mechanism. Narrative knowledge's narrative is epistemological. Optionality's narrative is instrumental. Narrative knowledge is trapped into a story. Optionality has no meaningful dependence on a story. The narrative can be just for motivation. Narrative knowledge has a narrow domain, closed space of action. Optionality has a broad domain, open space of action. Narrative knowledge needs to understand the logic of things. With optionality, little understanding is necessary, just rationality in comparing two outcomes, exercising the better option. Narrative knowledge doesn't benefit from the philosopher's stone, aka convexity bias, see chapter 19. Optionality relies on the philosopher's stone. All this does not mean that tinkering and trial and error are devoid of narrative. They are just not overly dependent on the narrative being true. The narrative is not epistemological, but instrumental. For instance, religious stories might have no value as narratives, but they may get you to do something convex and anti-fragile you otherwise would not do, like mitigate risks. English parents controlled children with the false narrative that if they didn't behave or eat their dinner, Boney, Napoleon Bonaparte, or some wild animal might come and take them away. Religions often use the equivalent method to help adults get out of trouble or avoid debt. But intellectuals tend to believe their own bullshit and take their ideas too literally, and that is vastly dangerous. Consider the role of heuristic rule-of-thumb knowledge embedded in traditions. Simply, just as evolution operates on individuals, so does it act on these tacit, unexplainable rules of thumb transmitted through generations, what Karl Popper has called evolutionary epistemology. But let me change Popper's idea ever so slightly, actually quite a bit. My take is that this evolution is not a competition between ideas, but between humans and systems based on such ideas. An idea does not survive because it is better than the competition, but rather because the person who holds it has survived. Accordingly, wisdom you learn from your grandmother should be vastly superior, empirically, hence scientifically, to what you get from a class in business school, and of course, considerably cheaper. My sadness is that we have been moving farther and farther away from grandmothers. Expert problems, in which the expert knows a lot, but less than he thinks he does, often bring fragilities and acceptance of ignorance the reverse. Expert problems put you on the wrong side of asymmetry. Let us examine the point with respect to risk. When you are fragile, you need to know a lot more than when you are anti-fragile. Conversely, when you think you know more than you do, you are fragile to error. We showed earlier the evidence that classroom education does not lead to wealth as much as it comes from wealth, an epiphenomenon. Next, let us see how, similarly, anti-fragile risk-taking, not education and formal organized research, is largely responsible for innovation and growth, while the story is dressed up by textbook writers. It does not mean that theories and research play no role. It is that just as we are fooled by randomness, so we are fooled into overestimating the role of well-sounding ideas. We will look at the confabulations committed by historians of economic thought, medicine, technology, and other fields that tend to systematically downgrade practitioners and fall into the green lumber fallacy.